I want to welcome you all to session 132, a panel entitled In the News, the Texas FLDS Situation, a topic that has captured the interest of not only Utah and Mormon Studies, but the entire nation. Much of the nation has been fascinated and many horrified by the recent events in which the Texas Child Protective Services Agency, acting on an anonymous tip, now seen as dubious in origin, initiated the removal of more than 400 children from the Yearning for Zion Ranch, founded by the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which I just prefer to call FLDS. This panel will explain the latest developments in the case, and the panelists will discuss the case from very different and unique cultural, scholarly, personal, professional perspectives. I'm the moderator, Maxine Hanks, a feminist theologian who lectures and writes on women's studies and religion and Mormonism. I've researched and published on polygamy since 1995 and edited the New York Times bestseller, Shattered Dreams, by Irene Spencer, which deals with her lifetime in the LeBaron sect in Mexico. I also am very fortunate to serve on the Utah Attorney General Safety Net Committee, but Paul Murphy really does all of the work, and he's here with us today as well. Our panelists are Ayla Saring Moon, who has a master's in women's spirituality, and she's a columnist writing for Sage Woman magazine. She's on the end with her baby. Next, we have Terry Roof, who has an MA in education, is a writing teacher, and counselor and advocate in the California juvenile court system, also a student ministry committee member at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And I'm kind of reading these out of order, but we have three more panelists. We also have Mary Batchelor, who serves on the Utah Safety Net, Utah-Arizona Safety Net Committee. She'll be doing a slide presentation, and Mary is also involved in the Principal Voices organization. We also have a reporter from the Deseret News, Ben Winslow, in the center, who's been covering polygamy for quite a long time. He's written a number of award-winning articles covering the topic, both here in Utah and in Salt Lake. And last but not least, I'm embarrassed to admit that I wasn't advised of the name of our final panelist.
I'm John Wolf.
Oh, sorry. Okay. For some reason, I don't see it here. I apologize, John. I don't see it here. Oh, here we go. John Walsh. I'm sorry. My fault. PhD, doing postdoctoral work in Nicene theology at St. Thomas Graduate School of Theology at St. Mary's Seminary in Houston, Texas. He was called as an expert witness during the FLDS hearings, and he spent considerable time interviewing and interacting with attorneys in the Texas case and with the FLDS members. So we're going to have a very spirited discussion. In terms of people who would present first, I think I'm going to start... why don't I start... do you have a preference? Why don't I start with you, Ayla? And Mary, would you prefer to be last? Or
It's not working, so it may just have to...
Okay. We'll let you be last in case we can get it working by then. Go ahead, Ayla.
Representing the mama scholars out there in the world today. So when the entire FLDS raids and Child Protective Services thing was going on, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do about it, but it was angering me so much, and I was trying to find these outlets to express why, that I ended up writing this 8 or 10 page just letter about what was wrong with this and why. And I really looked at it from an imperialist domination perspective. This was an imperial power, the Western United States government, coming in to a subculture and essentially trying to rape them by taking their children away and obliterate their culture. So this was the point I really wanted to speak to. And I kind of didn't know what to do with this paper I had written. And then Sunstone was coming up, and I was already on a giving a presentation, and I kind of ended up sending it to Dan and said, you want to do something with this? And he said, oh, we'll have a panel, so here we go. And can you present the FLDS situation in the context of imperialist power? So that's exactly what I did. And I was told to keep it short because there was a lot of panelists, so I just have one page I'm going to read. I kind of condensed this long thing that I ended up writing. Excuse me. So throughout history, the world over, just not just in America, imperialists have known how to break a culture. You take away their children. During the burning times in Europe, my own great-grandparents, seven times back, were thrown in jail, accused of witchcraft, along with their neighbors, and their children, eight total, ranging in ages from 17 to 4 years old, either starved to death or were shipped as indentured servants to the United States or to England to become maids. In the United States, Native American children were forcibly removed from their homes and given to white schools for re-education into Western culture. Children of the Sami, and that's spelled S-A-A-M-I for anyone who wants to know, the indigenous people of the Northern Europe and Russia area, were taken by the imperialist Europeans moving into the area and re-educated away from their tribal pagan culture in the 1900s. It's a pattern acted out across the globe by conquering armies and brutal leaders. Take the children, break the family, and then rebuild them in the image of the power at hand. Conformity through the cruelest torture, turning your own children against you. As a woman, as a mother, and as a feminist, I was both outraged at the U.S. government for perpetrating this crime against these women and children, but I was also equally outraged by the lack of response from the liberal, feminist, and motherhood communities of the United States and the world. This raid of the Texas FLDS community is nothing short of an imperialist assault on an ethnic and cultural minority. An ethnic and cultural minority was defined by the High Commissioner von der Stuhl in his keynote address at the opening of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe's Ministry Seminar in Warsaw, 1994. And he stated, first of all, a minority is a group with linguistic, ethnic, or cultural characteristics which distinguish it from the majority. Secondly, a minority is a group which usually not only seeks to maintain its identity, but also tries to give stronger impression to that identity. And I found that this quote on what a minority is just completely sums up the FLDS. I mean, they are specifically not within our culture. They are living their own lives, and they try very hard to give a strong impression of that through their dress. So we need to start seeing these men, women, and children of the FLDS with their conservative clothing, their long braided hair, their practice of simple living, and yes, even their practice of plural marriage as elements of their unique and valid culture, and certainly not automatic evidence of child abuse, either present or potential. If we let this invasion and rape of the FLDS community continue, who will be next? Will they perhaps remove the children of all polygamous or polyamorous transgender or homosexual families? Will they routinely be taking children away from any teen mothers in our country from now on? Will Child Protective Services be investigating Irish Catholic families with their eight children simply because they have a lot of children? What about the Amish with their style of dress, no electricity, young marriages, and large families? Will families controlling their children's education, either through home or private school, find themselves targeted next? And these were all elements and evidence that was given in what I read as to why the FLDS children needed to be taken, because of pregnant mothers, because of large families, because of not having access to electricity or what we would consider modern technology or the convenience thereof. And they're certainly not the only group to practice such things. As a united community of moms, dads, liberals, conservatives, feminists, homeschoolers, grandparents, aunts and uncles, etc., we must stand up and say no to what happened in Texas. We must put our feet down and say that suspected or potential abuse is no reason to strip the civil liberties of a group of people and exercise cookie-cutter politics upon them. We must rein in the rogue agency of Child Protective Services across this country and stop the abuse that they are visiting upon countless families who live alternative lifestyles. We should all care. And once we all realize we do, we all need to act. Thank you very much.
In all nations, mainstream culture must decide the rules of engagement that it uses with minority subcultures. Within the United States, one such subculture is the Mormon group known as the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. A different subculture is the Protestant group known as the Amish. In order to add a little context to the situation regarding the FLDS in Texas, I'd like to begin by very briefly discussing an aspect of Amish culture. When Amish children turn 16, many Amish communities allow them to participate in a cultural practice known as rumspringa, or running around. In this practice, Amish youth are allowed to experiment with the outside world in order to determine whether or not they want to make the commitment to live the severely ascetic Amish lifestyle. In many Amish communities, rumspringa will simply be a courting period, and please note that this period begins at 16. However, in some communities, these restrictions are lessened to the point that the children are allowed to experiment with alcohol, drugs, and sexuality to any degree they desire, with no questions asked by either the community or the parents. Then, at 18, they are asked to make a choice. Will they live among the English or Gentile outsiders, or will they be Amish and separate themselves from that world? Now, in most American communities, if you were to call up the state authorities and tell them that your next-door neighbor is allowing their teenage children to freely experiment with alcohol, drugs, and sex, all of which are technically illegal for someone of their age, and sometimes for someone of any age, the local authorities would directly intervene on the basis that the parents were neglectful. Yet in this case, while this practice is very widespread among Amish communities, local authorities in states such as Pennsylvania and Ohio have taken a very hands-off approach towards it. They do not handle it as a community-wide issue, despite its widespread prevalence, preferring instead to intervene only if an Amish minor is caught red-handed in an illegal situation, in which case the situations are resolved on a case-by-case basis, and almost never are the parents charged with any culpability. Let's contrast this restrained response to illegal activities by the Amish minority subculture to how authorities in Texas responded to allegations made against certain members of the FLDS in El Dorado. In the FLDS case, local authorities suspected that the FLDS subculture permitted marriage at an age younger than that permitted by the dominant mainstream culture. In response, we saw an aggressive military-style invasion in which the state of Texas sought to eliminate the FLDS community altogether by taking all of the community's children from their natural families and adopting them to other families so that they might be raised in the mainstream culture. When I was in San Angelo for the 14-day hearing, during a recess of my testimony before the court, I had a conversation with an attorney representing the state of Texas. As part of this conversation, I was curious as to why they were attempting to take very young children away from their parents. If there was evidence that teenage girls were being forced to marry against their will, I could understand why the state might seek custody of certain teenage girls. But I failed to see how this related to a young nursing baby boy, and there was one such that we were specifically discussing at the time. The fact that 40 years from now he might grow up to believe that he might be placed in a marriage to a teenage girl, not yet born, who might or might not agree to the match, seemed to me to be a little bit tenuous to take a baby away from his mother. The state representative then said something that I found quite surprising. She said that the reason that they were taking the boy that we were discussing, and all the other children as well, is that they had determined that the religious beliefs of this group of people were so spurious that no member of their religion could be allowed to raise children in Texas. She further said that before they removed the children, they had already determined to seek permanent custody by the state. She said that the state intended to adopt out every child possible and see that they were raised in good homes, such homes as they considered good. She said that the state considered it a horrible thing to be raised as FLDS, and that the state was determined to do everything possible to ensure that it didn't happen to a single child in Texas. Her indication that people automatically lose their natural parental rights and all associated legal protections simply through their association with the FLDS was an interesting point of view, though later invalidated by the higher courts. Moreover, the forcible transfer of children from one group to another is legally an act of genocide and a violation of international law. Specifically, it violates Article 2 of the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide that was adopted by the United Nations General Assembly in December 1948 and came into effect in January 1951. Today, 137 nations, including the United States of America, have ratified this convention. Article 3 of the convention states that not only the act itself, but conspiracy to commit the act, direct and public incitement to commit the act, attempting to commit the act, even if the act is ultimately unsuccessful, and even simple complicity in the act are all offenses that can be prosecuted by international bodies. It should be understood that government office and official license offer no immunity to prosecution. In fact, the vast majority of people who have been prosecuted under this convention were acting as government officials at the time the offenses were committed. Now, the next question I'd like to ask at this point is, why do the authorities ignore issues regarding the Amish and feel that genocide is the appropriate response to the FLDS? I know that the reason cannot be truly associated with teenage sex. Teenage sex is far less prevalent among the FLDS than it is among the Amish, where some claim that up to 12% of firstborn children are conceived prior to wedlock. Your average 16-year-old Amish girl is simply having more sex than your average 16-year-old FLDS girl, and yet no tanks have been sent into Amish communities. And if you think that the Amish are a little frisky, that is nothing compared to the normative sexual behaviors of Gentile teenagers in Texas. After my testimony during the 14-day hearing, I was required to sit outside the courtroom until it was decided whether I would be released as a witness or I would be called back again. During that time period, I had the opportunity to chat with an NBC News producer for several hours about various issues in the case. As it turned out, we were both Texans who had attended high school in Texas. Somehow we got onto the issue of teenage sex, and I made the comment that in my high school, which is Willow Ridge High School and Clements High School, for those who are taking notes, 90% of my high school class was sexually active by the time we graduated. She looked at me, and she said that she thought that less than half of the 15-year-old freshman girls in her high school class were virgins. The fact is that fornication is the number one recreational activity in your average Texas high school. Because of their ascetic and puritanical ideas about sex, the fact is also that even the few teenage FLDS girls who are married and are still having less sex than your typical girl of the same age within the Gentile community. Therefore, even if it were true that a few cases of teenage sex exist within the FLDS community of El Dorado, it does not seem rational that they could be used to justify the genocide that occurred. It might be suggested that polygamy is the real cause of the actions taken by the state of Texas. The claim has often been made that polygamy as a practice is inherently abusive towards women. This idea is often based upon the idea that polygamy gives all the normal areas of power in a relationship exclusively to men. In this view, men control the sex, money, and decision-making. Of course, the issue has been debated between proponents and detractors of polygamy many times. Female advocates of polygamy often respond to this allegation by pointing out all the ways in which they feel they have real power in their lives, and instead of being debilitating, polygamy has actually empowered them far beyond what monogamy offers them. To this defense, those against polygamy will often say that these women are simply brainwashed. And since April, we have certainly heard a large number of claims that all FLDS women are brainwashed. However, I believe that the issue has been framed incorrectly. Regarding the media stories about the FLDS since the invasion, it seems that many people associate the term polygamy far beyond its proper meaning. For example, Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland, who co-chairs a government commission on human rights, said he was shocked to hear how women and children are treated in the polygamous lifestyle. Senator Cardin and many others have obviously forgotten that calling someone a polygamist simply means that person is involved in a polyamorous, meaning multiple and simultaneous loving and sexual relationships. The term polygamy has nothing whatsoever to do with how a polygamist treats those with whom they maintain such relationships. Some polygamists are loving and kind people, and others are cruel and despotic. Their ethical values and how they live them have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with whether or not they are polygamists. further as an attempt to define Mormon fundamentalists as the other, that folklore's entity responsible for all the world's evils. They forget that within American culture, polygamy is very widespread and there are many forms that such relationships take. They might be informal, semi-formal, or formal. Informal polygamous relationships might be reflected by unmarried Americans who choose to date and experience sexually a variety of people instead of settling down. Hookups and friends with benefits are terms and associations that are very mainstream in American society today. The polygamous relationships may be semi-formal, but still lack any depth of lifelong commitment. Hugh Hefner and the girls next door might be examples of these kind of polygamous relationships. Not only are they polygamous, but they have a reality show on TV about it. Then we have the slightly more formal relationships, such as that found in Mormon, Protestant, and Islamic fundamentalism. To further articulate the point I'm trying to make, let me very briefly tell you about the first polygamous family I ever met. I met this family as a young college student while living in Houston, Texas in the 1980s. So this was a Texas polygamous family, and therefore there is some relevance to polygamy in Texas. However, they were not FLDS. In fact, they were not associated with Mormon fundamentalism whatsoever. They were, in fact, neo-pagans. For those unfamiliar with neo-paganism, let me say that in general, it is a spiritual movement that attempts to revive ancient polytheistic religions of Europe and the Middle East. They are often associated with ritual magic and modern witchcraft. Interestingly, like many Mormon fundamentalists, many neo-pagans, of which there are several hundred thousand in the United States, are polygamous, such as the family I'm about to discuss. However, unlike Mormon fundamentalists who have a conservative patriarchal culture, most neo-pagans have a liberal matriarchal culture. In this family, who became good friends of mine, there was one husband and two wives. The husband stayed home and took care of the children while both of his wives worked at professional jobs in the field of medicine. In the religious life, the older wife was the high priestess of her religious community. In this polygamous family, the women controlled the sex, the money, and the decision-making. So they stand in stark contrast to the FLDS community, even though both communities allow the practice of polyamorous relationships. With this understanding, let me reframe the issue of abuse. If there is any truth to the idea that Mormon polygamous women, especially those of the FLDS, are systematically abused by their culture, it is not due to their polygamous relationships. My neo-pagan friends prove that it's possible for multiple women to share one man and still control all the important areas of power within their relationships. No, if there is any truth to the allegation of systematic abuse, we must look at the other side of the expression, Mormon polygamist. The Mormon side, to be more precise. To be clear, I am saying that polygamous and polyamorous relationships simply reflect that multiple and simultaneous loving or sexual relationships are maintained. The general quality of Mormon polygamous relationships are reflected by the cultural context of Mormonism. Let's be real for a moment. If Hugh Hefner and his three companions were to suddenly arrive in Texas for a visit, does anybody here seriously believe that Governor Rick Perry and Attorney General Greg Abbott would be meeting them at the airport with tanks and sniper rifles? So, what is the answer? I cannot say with scientific certainty. Scholars have been discussing the Salem witch trial since 1692, and we still don't have definitive answers to that one. I suspect we will be trying to understand this situation for a very long time to come. However, I strongly suspect that if these people had been part of a fundamentalist Protestant subgroup instead of a Mormon subgroup, then the state of Texas would have taken a much more measured response to the allegations regarding the FLDS.
My name is Ben Winslow, and with the Deseret News, I don't really have any prepared remarks, and I'm just the messenger here, so I take no opinion on the subject matter. But as far as the latest with the FLDS Church, we all know what happened in April when law enforcement responded to a phone call from someone claiming to be a 16-year-old girl who was pregnant and in an abusive marriage to an older man. They responded. CPS says that once on site, they saw other signs of abuse, which prompted a judge to order the removal of all of the children. Days later, and hundreds of children later, two Texas courts ruled that the state acted improperly and ordered the children returned. The latest now is the cases still continue. There have been eight petitions filed in a Texas court just this week seeking to remove some of these children from foster care, or excuse me, to place them in foster care. arguing that their parents are doing nothing to protect them from men involved in underage marriages. On the other side, there were 32 children this week, or 32 cases rather, involving what they call non-suits, which means that Child Protective Services seeks to no longer have jurisdiction over them. Six indictments have been handed down by a grand jury investigating all of this on charges ranging from sexual assault to bigamy to failure to report child abuse. All have posted bail, with the exception of FLDS leader Warren Jeffs, who, as we know, remains in an Arizona jail. Parenting classes are underway for all of the parents who are still under CPS's jurisdiction. Those continue even today. Grand jury continues to meet in Schleicher County. It's scheduled to meet again later this month. There are two tracks for this case to keep in mind. There is the child welfare investigation, which continues, according to CPS. I checked just before I came over here. That case still continues, as well as the criminal investigation, which is very much underway with hundreds, if not thousands, of pieces of evidence, most particularly involving documentation from the FLDS themselves that was seized. That evidence, of course, is being challenged in court on the legality of the seizure, as well as religious reasons, priest-penitent privilege between FLDS leadership and their followers. The allegations, there are also allegations of abuse, of course, coming from the government, versus allegations of religious persecution. That at this point, there, it seems, at least from those of us in the media field covering it, there really appears to be no black and white. It's really just shades of gray. So.
Obstacle course here.
My name is Terry Ruth, and I am. My remarks are really coming from a little different. Can you hear me? Okay, a little different place, in that as a person working in education profession for about 30 years, I've been in a position of being a mandated reporter of child abuse. And I wanted to share with you several scenarios that you may ask how this relates to the ranch in Texas. But I would hope you would see what the point of view that I'm coming from is the person who is hearing the story of children or adolescents. Let me show you what I'm, or tell you what I'm trying to explain here. I have worked as an educator in elementary school teaching. I've worked with the Santa Barbara Police Department on gang awareness. I've been a high school teacher in a juvenile court system, and I presently am an instructor in a community city college. So I'm fairly well versed on different kinds of child abuse, whether it's physical, emotional, sexual, or simply neglect. This is a responsibility I've taken quite seriously. First and foremost, for the safety of any child, any one child. But also keeping in mind, as a mandated reporter, that I have legal ramifications for myself as well as my institutions from which I've worked and served. As a mandated reporter, I am subject to the laws of the state. One thing's quite clear to me. Child abuse can and does occur across all strata of society, be that religious, ethnic, cultural, socioeconomic. The outstanding difference is, I find, that the poor, or those that are disenfranchised, are often less able to keep the abuse as well hidden as those who can hide behind positions of status and wealth and are often the least suspected. I leave it to you to into which category you might put the those that are on the ranch of Texas. While teaching a classroom, of third graders about alcohol and drugs, an 8-year-old boy said to me, he raised his hand, and in my presence and the rest of the classmates, that he knew that drinking too much was not a good thing. Because when his dad got drunk, his dad would pull a knife on his mother if she didn't fix his lunch. And this was told as if, well, this is what happens. And I have to admit, one of the alarming things was that the other members of the class didn't seem that alarmed as well. This child shared this story as if it were nothing out of the ordinary, and simply wanted me to know that he understood what I was talking about, and he had a very good example. This was one of those situations when I must admit, at the moment I was thinking, way too much information. However, the cat was out of the bag. Everybody was to hear this. And interestingly, the other children didn't seem to be alarmed, as I said. All in the day of an 8-year-old's life. I'll never forget the drive home that day, thinking how much and how does this child get through every day, facing this kind of trauma day in and day out. How would he grow up, and how is he going to treat his wife or children, should he have them? Would he solve his problems by drinking too much and threatening to harm them? Did he know an alternative? Would he ever come upon an alternative way to deal with the problems that he was facing? Or might this intervention break that cycle of violence? Now, not all instances of abuse are quite so blatant and forthcoming, and I hope you would understand that as a person who is a mandated reporter, I was left no alternative but to make a report to CPS. Teaching in a juvenile court school, I all too often saw young people who were abused by family members, mistreated by law enforcement, and ridiculed by the school system. Continue that cycle of violence, not only to others, but to themselves. A female student, Liz, a senior, was a cutter. She cut her arms up and down, both of them, with a razor. She almost always wore long-sleeve shirts, so it was quite by accident that I even saw what she had done. She was embarrassed, to say the least, but she was forthright in telling me about the sexual assaults by a family member that had gone on since she was prepubescent. She told her mother, but her mother either chose not to believe her or to put the blame on Liz, saying she must have encouraged it. And nobody wanted to make anybody angry. Silence was the family's answer. The secret was to be kept. That is, until Liz found someone she felt she could trust with her secret. Again, an intervention that brought counseling for Liz, for someone that could now validate her feelings, someone who could listen to her and hear her pain. One final story. I also had a number of pregnant teenage moms and dads. And yes, the Gentiles do have seemingly a great playtime. And sex is often one of them, as well as, of course, alcohol and drugs. We often talked about how they would be parents to their children, young parents. And then I would often ask, what is it that you'd like to change as a parent? What is it that you really don't like about what your parents do to you? And most often the answer would be, Well, the worst thing is that they beat me and they yell at me, and I don't ever want to do that for my child. So I ask, when your two-year-old picks up a dish on the coffee table, what's going to be your response? Usually a very big question comes across the face because, again, they're thinking, what is there to do but just hit the child, to yell at the child? So, again, would this intervention bring about change? Would they be able to take parenting classes? Would they at least learn some alternative methods of parenting that, again, might break that cycle of violence? We know that children, even when abused, love their parents dearly, defend their parents, and want to be with their parents. And I think this is one of the things that's been voiced and needs to be heard loud and clear, especially considering the children in Texas who seemingly were so picked up and carried away from their parents. I can only imagine the fear and the heartbreak that went on for children as well as their parents. We know that children are usually very resilient. How many of us have lived through pain, mistreatment, hardships, and we still persevere, don't we? We learn to cope because that's how we get through life, is by learning to cope with whatever that pain or horror that we may have to face. But some are not so lucky. When children live in isolation without adults that they can trust, if indeed that is the case, as the mother of Liz, then can the home become a prison rather than a foundation? There are children countless that carry the wounds of abuse throughout a lifetime. Some are scarred beyond healing. They keep their secrets hidden inside that fester and often metastasize. Reporting child abuse gives a child at least the possibility of escaping the violence or mistreatment in his or her world. It opens the door to a safer, more caring possibility. It opens the door to a life of dignity and self-respect, and it also says to a child that you're not alone. You have value, and I will advocate on your behalf. I'm not in a position to judge the methodology used by CPS at the Yearling for Zion Ranch. However, when children live in isolation, and especially in a submissive environment, I think we must be vigilant in our watch over our children, that is, all of our children. Dr. C. Henry Kemp, a pioneer in the field of child abuse prevention, once said he would rather apologize to a parent he made a mistake about reporting the abuse than to apologize to a brain-damaged or sexually molested child because he did not report. It is better to err in the direction of over-reporting than under-reporting, he says. To those who cry violation of religious freedom, I say, freedom of religion does not extend to physical or sexual abuse of children. The state, I think, has an obligation to protect children from such horror. And when in doubt, the government must put the safety and welfare of children first. Thank you.
Hey, Mary, take it away.
I actually have a PowerPoint, but I'm going to have a couple introductory comments before we move to that. And I'm hoping that we will have the people come in and manage to get the lights out in the room so you can actually see it. I'm Mary Batchelor. I'm the director of Principal Voices. My organization is an advocacy education organization. We work on behalf of polygamous families, women and children from polygamous families. We have been actively involved with performing trainings for CPS workers, law enforcement, nonprofit organizations, and anyone who provides services to any abuse situations or other services to societies. These communities, because of the nature of the criminal nature of polygamy, are afraid. There would be more fear for them to reach out if there is a situation of domestic violence or abuse. For example, one of the examples that I think would help you understand to put it into perspective would be if you have an undocumented immigrant in America and that person is subject to domestic violence or has an abuse situation, that person is going to be very afraid to turn to law enforcement or call a service agency when they are in fear that they may, as a result of that phone call, be prosecuted or sent out of the country. So when you take into account the fact that the polygamous lifestyle itself can be prosecuted under the bigamy statute, then that fear is a similar fear. So when people have situations of abuse or domestic violence, our goal is to refer them to appropriate agencies and help them get the resources and help that they need. But we also wish to educate government agencies, nonprofits, service-oriented agencies so that they can provide services where the focus is not polygamy, the focus is, in fact, abuse. We have also brought in service providers to a variety of the groups. The Davis County Co-op, which is commonly referred to as the Kingston Group, the All Red Group, which is the Apostolic United Brethren, Centennial Park, and many of the independents who are not affiliated with any group have had trainings on domestic violence, on how to recognize abuse, how it is defined, how to see it, and how to deal with it within your community, and to reach out and refer to services that are necessary. The only way we have been able to do these trainings and gain this access is through a continuing opening of these communities and through the trust that we have achieved in working with them. The raid really was very upsetting to all of these communities, as you can imagine, to even to us. And being from the culture myself, I'm not a member of the FLDS community, I am actually an independent, I know that fear. So I knew immediately what we were going to be dealing with. This is not just touch the FLDS community. This is a fear that threatens to send all of these communities underground or these families back into hiding. And it cuts off their contact and their ability to get the services they need, to get the resources they need. And the very things that were touched upon by the prior speaker, the necessity of having these issues addressed and having these families reached and having abuse victims helped, is so great that this is something that we cannot impress upon you strongly enough. The communities need to be open. We need to have that dialogue. As a result of the raid, Principal Voices doubled its efforts, or tripled its efforts, I should say, to reach out to the FLDS community. This is one community we have not been able to work with. We have not had contact with. All of our efforts to reach them were gently and very kindly rebuffed. As a response, however, to our efforts to reach out to them this time, they did open a dialogue with us. And we have now a contact person within their community that we can now speak with. We are continuing to build a relationship with them, and we are hoping that this dialogue will continue and will have a good and positive impact on them and their families. Now, I'm actually going to take that and come down here so I can point some things out. This was a trip to the ranch that Heidi and I made when about 2 weeks after the kids were returned. Now, only a portion of the family, I don't even know that it was as many as a third. Maybe Ben would know better. But only a portion of the families returned to the ranch. The rest of the families did not leave the FLDS community, did not leave their husbands or their families or their group, but they settled in other parts of the state because their children had been sent all over the state. Some of them had signed service plans already and as well had gotten homes and signed leasing agreements with those homes where they are obligated to maintain those homes. The number one reason that they did not return to the ranch was their fear that their children would be taken from them again if they returned to the ranch. And they wanted to comply with the requirements of the state agency so that they could keep their children.
You have to stay there for the tape.
Oh, bummer. Okay, well, I can see the picture, so I'll work from here. Okay, I just want to point out that this, again, is a snapshot of this community at this time. Anytime people have gone in or out of the community, largely media, you're seeing it at the moment. A lot of the media were able to go in, but shortly after the raid, when it was really traumatic and they saw a lot of chaos and experienced the trauma and the charged feeling in the air from having the children taken and having this raid occur. For us, it was very peaceful and serene. It was actually a very fascinating experience for me with a Mormon background to see some of the early Mormon principles in practice in this ranch. Can we get can the lights go off even more by any chance? I wonder. There's no one here to do that.
Turn the lights down.
Yeah, can you guys see that very well? Because it's not that bright.
It looks like a black building.
It looks like a black building. This is their temple, the temple that went up in the time, the 4 years that they have been living there. I hope you didn't turn it off. Some of the pictures are some things that you have not seen on TV. Is that helpful? Okay. This is Fort Concho. Now, this is the building. You can see how narrow this building is. It's long but narrow. But this is where all over 400 children and the mothers that went with them were moved after they had been in the Coliseum, and the Coliseum became an untenable place.
No,
right? Oh, it was before the Coliseum. Oh, okay. This was the first place it was at. You can see that this is a very small building. This is actually a museum. So it was really not set up. It was not a good facility, but it was all they had at the time, I think, to really put them into, and ultimately they moved into the Coliseum. This is another shot, also to show the lawn. The media were actually in public, were kept even further away from this. So any shots that you saw in the media about this place or this location, if there were any pictures that were closer than this, it would have been from a lens that made it look like it was closer. But that just shows you the small building that these people were all in. Next one. Oh, yeah, this is the fire department. Now, this actually is within, this is inside the ranch, and it is in the carpentry shop. It's on one side of the carpentry shop, and this is just the beginning of what will be their fire department. They have already gone out and fought fires for their neighbors in the El Dorado area. Now, you can imagine, this is a desert area. I mean, they've got a lot of sagebrush and dry land that a raging fire could wipe out acres and acres. So they have already gone out and helped in the firefighting efforts, and we thought that was pretty neat. We didn't know that existed. Go ahead. Up in the top left corner is our kits. This is a kit of a Lincoln log cabin that were sent to the ranch by other members of the FLDS from other areas, and they sent, I don't know how many of these they sent, but there were boxes lined up everywhere to give to the children. This is just an example of some of the toys that they do have, and they are handmade by other members of their community. In the lower picture, you can see chairs and bed railings. Their carpentry shop, they make all their own furniture for the community. They also make their moldings, their doors. A lot of the work on their homes and everything comes from their own community. One of the things that impressed me about what I saw is how self-sustaining this community really is within the ranch itself, but also they have other members who live in other locations that also do other things and send them back and forth. So we were able to experience some of those. I was very impressed with the carpentry shop. There were two floors. They put great quality into their work. They actually tried to put quality into their work. You could see they had me sit on several chairs where they had tested the padding and the cushion of the chairs to see what would be the most comfortable, and I agreed that the one they chose was, in fact, the most comfortable. Go ahead. Now, this is the gravel pit. This just shows a scene from the highest point. at the ranch, and this is the gravel pit. I don't think there was anything in particular at the gravel pit, right? No. This is not the gravel pit where the temple was taken. The tools to make the temple were not taken from this gravel pit. Go ahead. Now, this is on the other side of the gravel pit. This shows an interesting thing that we never knew about the ranch. There is no dirt, of any real dirt, at this ranch. It's like all rock on the ground. So what they do is when they clear a spot of land, they take whatever dirt is there and trees and branches, and they mulch the trees and they make piles of different things. So you have a rock pile, you have a tree pile, and you have some other brush in the corner. Everything that you see here, they will use in some capacity in the ranch. What they do with some of these branches and trees and the dirt is they built up gardens. They could not have a garden where they could dig down into the ground, so they had to take the dirt from other parts of the ranch and build a garden up from the ground and then plant down in that dirt. And you will see in a later picture they had to do this for their fruit trees, where they had to actually build up little mounds to plant the trees in so the tree roots could take root. And the reason I'm showing these in particular, as you go on, we'll talk about it. Go ahead. That's another shot of the valley from the top of the gravel pit. And you can see a house. This is a two-story house. And then the temple again. And you can also see that the lawns on this picture are green. So they are maintaining the temple grounds. Yeah. Oh. It does show, actually, by comparison, how tall the temple is, since you can see that it's next to a two-story building here. Go ahead. That's Heidi and me posing and to show the distance of the temple and from here. But also, we had this pointed out to us, that this is the place where seven snipers were set up on this hill. One sniper aimed at each house that they could see from this hill. Now, this shows that they are putting in a sewer system, and you can see the rock. We took these pictures specifically so you could see that, number one, they're putting in a sewer system, which is no easy task, and number two, there's no dirt here. They're digging through absolute rock, and you can see the thickness of the rock, and there's an example of that rock as it looks. So they do about 100 feet per day, and the machine keeps breaking down because it is really a labor-intensive project. Now, when we went here, we had already seen the dairy and where they raise their own cattle as well. We were not given a tour of those individual places. We actually were there for 4.5 hours, I believe, and so by that point, we had time constraints. But go ahead. This is where the gardens were. We had this child pose on with this. He was tickled to pose on this machine, by the way. One of the things we noticed with these people is that they really do have diverse personalities here. There were a lot of different kinds of personalities. Some were very spunky, and some were very quiet and subdued. The kids were really happy to be spunky. And when they were corrected by their parents, what we saw was a very gentle, mild correction, asking them to move or redirecting them, which I consider appropriate disciplining. And we had several other boys pose around this machine after they found out we were not media. They would not pose for us until we told them we were not media. I wonder if this qualifies us now as media, but go ahead. Now you can see that this is the fruit trees, and you can see the mounds where the fruit trees have been built up. They have all varieties of fruit trees. I mean, they listed off just one after another after another. They also raise their own nuts and a variety of crops in their garden. We didn't get a picture of their garden. These are all community gardens or community groves. And we were full of questions. Well, how does that work? How do you know how much food do you take? And how do you divide the labor? And they had actually signs that were on the gardens of this part of the garden is the fifth grade boys' part to take care of. And they would come in and weed it and take care of that garden. That was their part. And they were also supposed to harvest the plants from that garden. And we asked them what they did with the harvest, if after they harvested it, they get to take it home. And no, actually what they did was all of the labor is technically donated. That's the work that they do for the community and for themselves. They turn in everything they harvest to their bishop's storehouse. And at the storehouse, then, all the food goes to there, all the clothing goes to there, when someone needs food or clothing or any of those things, they come in and they take what they need. That's all they take. And the philosophy from them was, we give back more than we take. And when I heard them say, I did hear the expression, we're just keeping it sweet. And it's an interesting thing because I had never heard that expression, even having been raised in a fundamentalist Mormon family with relatives who lived polygamy, I had never heard the expression keep sweet until I heard it in the media. And so it was interesting to come onto this property and actually hear them using that expression. And I have to say, there was no guile in it. There was no pride. There was no arrogance. There was no force or coercion in it. The message simply was, this is who I am. It was genuine. It was humble. I believe in keeping sweet. Go ahead. This is a personal picture for me. While I was there, they took me to meet my great-aunt Marjorie, who I did not know was there until members of the media actually saw her there and told me that she was there. She apparently moved to the ranch about a month and a half before the raid. She moved to live there with one of her daughters and their children. When the raid occurred, many of those families were, of course, displaced, and hers was one of them. So her daughter and her children have not returned to the ranch. There were five, I would call them matriarchs, I'm not sure if that's how they refer to them in this community, who were living in this home. The home was up somewhat behind and to the left of the temple, so not from this window, but from a window on this side. You can overlook the temple from this room. But these five women were brought to this one home and are being cared for there by a family, while their relatives have been displaced in other parts of Texas. When I sat down with my Aunt Marjorie, she pulled out family pictures and my ancestors that I know that are in my collection, and then she pointed to pictures on the wall and asked me if I know who those people were on the wall. Well, of course, I recognized Warren Jeffs and Roland Jeffs and Leroy Johnson, and I said, yes, I did know them, but I didn't know them personally. And she said it had been her pleasure and her honor to know them personally in her lifetime. When I was speaking to this woman, not only, of course, do I love her as my great aunt, but it became very clear to me that she is well cared for. She is fed healthy food that they raise right there on the ranch. And every home we went into was home-baked bread. In fact, they served meal to us while we were there, which I understand is also pretty unique for an outsider to be able to come in and participate in that way. She was very happy. I have no fear and no worry over this woman being cared for well in this ranch. Whether or not I agree with her or believe in her belief system, she fully and firmly believes it. She is at peace at 89 years old. She is more at peace. I hope I can have that peace when I reach that time in my life. But I just wanted to end with that so you can have an understanding of the other side. In my feelings that when you really want to help people, that first you do no harm. And second, you find the strengths and the beauties that they have in their culture because everyone has them. And you work from those strengths and you help them to then help themselves to overcome whatever weaknesses or failings may be there. I think the open dialogue is the first step that whatever problems may exist in this community or whatever abuses may be there can now we can start to solve and resolve. I thank you for this opportunity to share this experience with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mary. Add a few comments and then we'll go to questions. 10 years ago this summer, in May 1998, a 16-year-old in Box Elder County called the sheriff's office with a report of severe abuse after she had crawled for nearly a mile or more to get to a phone. Brent Hunsaker referred to this later as the belt whipping heard around the world. But this was a wake-up call to the Utah community about the reality of abuse within a closed religious polygamous community when Marianne Kingston, her case, came to public light that year. Did Marianne Kingston have a case? Yes. And it was properly made, resulting in arrest. Did the Texas CPS
10 years later this summer have a case? I would say yes, but it was not properly made. The CPS actions were not specific enough and evidence was not assembled properly. One problem was the complexity and scope of the family system they were dealing with. They were not prepared to deal with a family system of over 400 people with multiple families living in one dwelling and a tribal system. This was not a nuclear family, and the standards for dealing with child abuse normally apply to a nuclear family situation. Another problem was one of perspective or paradigm in the clash between child advocates and child attorneys in a court situation. Sociologists and lawyers don't have the same approach to child abuse, so they were approaching it from different ends of the problem. I would say that in one way, critics on both sides are wrong, because it's not just about the religious persecution of polygamists. It's about protecting children. And on the other side, it's not just about the religious power of polygamists. It's about child abuse in the court system and how it works. CPS needed to prove specific individual harms, and it's not that the evidence of immediate harm was not there. It just wasn't assembled specifically enough to meet the rule of law to satisfy legal requirements for each child in relation to their own parents. It's an important fact that the government can't and should not invade families and remove children due to poor parenting of all types or harmful beliefs. We live in a country where we have the right to be misled and mistaught. It requires proof of abuse on an individual basis. It also depends on how you define and prove abuse. Abuse includes physical, sexual, and emotional abuse, according to the code in Utah and Arizona. And as far as I know, in Texas, although I tried to research the Texas code and it looked like it was a week-long project, but I assume that it's included. As the Arizona Attorney General noted in our media conference in May, the definition of emotional abuse meets some of those criteria for the abuse of children that is immediate and where harm is real. Because meanwhile, the harms are real. The raid revealed, and please, Ben and Mary, correct me if I don't have the latest statistics, because I may not, but the raid revealed that about 20 girls had given birth between the ages of 12 and 18 at some point in the past, and five of which were still under 18, and one of which was currently pregnant. The raid also revealed that Warren Jeffs had had intimate physical relations with at least two young teen girls.
No? It's not been proven.
Okay. It's been charged by the photographs.
It's alleged.
Thank you. Thank you. And please correct me. It's also not known that a few of the children, reportedly teenage boys, have opted not to return to the community but to stay with their foster families. And in fact, I think Shannon mentioned that even though the media has reported that there was this mass return, and again, correct me, Shannon said that it was only about 150 who'd returned so far. Do you know?
To the
actual ranch, but they're not left the community, so to speak.
Okay.
They're staying in, like, San Antonio to stay in, like, CPS's good grade.
Okay. So it's hard to get exact statistics out of this case, which is rapidly evolving. Meanwhile, just to touch on some of the abuses, which we all know about, but it's important to mention, there are cases where abuse is not happening in a family group with a mother and her children, and other cases where there is child abuse and sexual abuse and underage marriage. I would also add that there are cases of incest and inbreeding. I would add also there's a lack of access to proper free public education and public and social services. I would say there's a lack of freedom of speech and a lack of freedom of religion within that community. I would say that these are not consenting adults, but coerced participants. In fact, this raises another issue that I think is central to this case, which is the issue of theocracy. For example, public services buildings, etc., in Hilldale and Colorado City are owned by the FLDS. For example, when I went to visit the health center, the public health center built with public funds, it was surrounded by high walls and cameras, and you weren't able to get in apparently, unless you're an FLDS in good standing. The whole notion of theocracy is, to me, central in this issue, because it's not just about an alternative culture or people trying to get back to nature or living out in the country. It's about establishing a higher divine form of government that is seen as superior to democracy, a priesthood order of government. I would say that in some ways, the FLDS are exploiting democracy to create a theocracy that seeks to undermine or overthrow the democracy that it is exploiting in order to create itself. I would say it's not just about an alternative family type. It's about an alternative country, a government of God, an authoritarian male priesthood, fundamentalist, polygynous God who directs that government. Meanwhile, back to the situation in Texas, I would say that the joint approach taken by the Arizona Attorney General's offices and their safety net committee is a sound one, even if slow. Utah culture is enmeshed historically, culturally, socially, genetically, religiously, and politically with Mormon polygyny. Utah has an inside track on the pros and cons. We wouldn't exist or be here without polygamy. I wouldn't exist or be here without polygamy, having a polygamous great-great-grandfather. Still, I would not condemn the Texas CPS raid, which was an outsider view, a contemporary American mindset looking in on a rapidly expanding theocratic religious community that married and impregnated underage girls. I would say that both approaches, the Utah approach and the Texas approach, and both perspectives are needed. One is insider, one is outsider. One is careful, one is confrontational. One is deliberate, one is drastic. Much like the sociological view of child protection advocates in the courts and the legal viewpoints of attorneys in the courts, together these two approaches address a complex social problem of massive scope and far-reaching implications. Meanwhile, back to the issue of theocracy. Today's Mormon fundamentalists are besieged and blamed for their lifestyle, their beliefs, and their theocratic attempts at community. And yet, of course, this precedent was set by the founder of Mormonism, Joseph Smith, and goes back to Mormon communities in Ohio, Missouri, and, of course, Nauvoo. In fact, in 1844, Joseph Smith said, "The world is governed too much, and there is not a nation or a dynasty now occupying the earth which acknowledges Almighty God as their lawgiver. I go emphatically, virtuously, and humanely for a theodemocracy, where God and the people hold the power to conduct the affairs of men in righteousness. I calculate to be one of the instruments of setting up the kingdom of Daniel by the word of the Lord, and I intend to lay a foundation that will revolutionize the whole world." This ties back to John Walsh's comments, which I found fascinating. I like the way he brought up the Amish community. And I think the issue of theocracy is particularly interesting in comparing the Amish and the way that they build community in comparison to the Mormon fundamentalists. But still, the central issue, as I see it, is this tension between free agency or coercion. Is this really consenting adults, or is this ideological coercion? Are we viewing all of these teenage girls and young women as truly free to choose, or are they ideologically coerced by a commandment that they cannot live in heaven with God unless they practice polygamy on earth? Meanwhile, this month, or actually July, on Pioneer Day, July 24th, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid from Nevada sponsored legislation and hearings to create a task force on criminal conduct and to review the case of the FLDS in Texas. He cited the case and the situation in Texas as a form of organized crime that includes welfare fraud, tax evasion, corruption, and child abuse. Also in July, a Texas grand jury indicted Warren Jeffs and five of his male followers on felony charges of child sexual assault or failure to report child abuse.
That's a misdemeanor.
Okay, sorry. Thanks. So not felony, misdemeanor. And separately, 234 individual child cases are being examined in Texas. Is that right? So that's where we are. And I now turn this over to questions.
I just would want to say a couple things. I'm from Texas, and I've been following this very closely, and also it should have plagued me forever. I've read everything, because I'm completely in this family. I feel like I'm well-grounded, and I have to say, I have to disagree with so many people, because I think that the Texas DPS really acted in good faith. I'll tell you, I've read articles in our paper, seen our interviews, you know, where they, the sincerity and, you know, see them justify what they did and then make the corrections as they needed to. I read in the papers in Utah, it was like it was a totally different thing. But see, remember, in Texas, as you pointed out, they're not emotionally involved in polygamy. It's just strange. They were, like you say, they were totally unprepared. But I defend them because I know their heart's in the right place, and they're concerned about the children. And they just weren't, they just, the closed society, they just didn't know what they were getting into. They really didn't. And my son lived up in York, Pennsylvania, so I visited the Amish a lot, and I don't even think they're comparable because they're totally open. You know, I mean, they don't live in closed communities. It's just, it's lovely. You know, anybody can see everything there.
Thank you. Question?
I have a question about abuse. There was a letter that made the case that systematic abuse of boys was required mathematically by a closed system of polygamy, simply because you must either selectively abort males or you must sometime during their teenage years remove them from the community so that as parents have male children, they know that X percent of them will have to be removed, and that was the argument, and I don't know how that argument holds up, but I was very interested in that.
First, I want to point out that, number one, I think that would only apply in a very limited, geographic, controlled environment. Most of the polygamous groups and polygamous communities are actually living right here in and out and among everybody else. What we have learned is probably at most about a third of children from polygamous families actually enter into polygamy or follow in their parents' footsteps. They may still embrace the belief system, but they don't necessarily practice polygamy. There's also, depending on what community you're in, I mean, there's a large number of independents. I'm an independent. So my kids actually are raised, they go to public school. I'm the only one of my parents' children who lived polygamy, and I'm currently not living polygamy. So the numbers are small. They actually get higher in communities like the FLDS. Clearly, they have a large number of their children that are still entering into polygamy. They are a much more closed community as far as interaction with outsiders, and this is the only community that I am aware of where I have seen lost boys. I mean, I'm not familiar with any lost boys from any of the other communities. That does not mean that the children do not choose other lifestyles, because clearly they do. But that's what maintains the ratios, actually, in the other communities, is that the children actually grow up and, in fact, freely choose other ways of life.
I can't answer the question about babies and, you know, those stats, but the lost boy phenomenon, where teenage boys are turned out of the community and have no skills and no place to go, has been a serious problem addressed by the Utah Attorney General's Office and the Safety Net Committee and various organizations to help give those boys training and places to live. But I will say that one problem with a closed theocratic society is that it doesn't receive the normal, usual government investigations about population and epidemiology and mortality rates and morbidity rates. And this is something I've been concerned about trying to see if that can be remedied, because when they're closed, we're not having the normal types of surveillance and statistics. Okay.
I live here, and I've been trying to be informed about this because I like to discuss it with people who also try to be informed. I have seen no evidence of welfare abuse in this particular group in Texas. Now, maybe you could help me with that. I have been quoting the fact that I haven't seen any evidence of welfare abuse, and I wondered if there's anyone here who knows and if they could tell me if I'm correct.
Texas child welfare records show no one, at least in Texas.
That's in this particular group.
In the YSC Ranch community.
In the El Dorado area, which they, you know, there's no evidence of anyone.
I should repeat that into the mic. So, according to Ben Winslow, Texas shows no welfare abuse in that in the case of the
no one even
on welfare in the FLDS community in Laredo. Okay. Thanks for it. That was a great point. Yes.
I'm curious to know the difference between the polygamous groups that feel they have to isolate themselves and be very, very closed. One of our friends in Northern California, we lived outside of Utah in our adult life, but I grew up in Sugar House. And we were told that the three-story house that was kitty corner from Forest School, which isn't even there anymore, was the polygamous temple for the Utah polygamists that lived around us. And when our friends from Northern California bought a lovely home here in Salt Lake and moved up, they thought it was humorous that they had moved into a neighborhood where many, many families were polygamous and lived in lovely homes. Their children went to public schools. And I can remember her saying once, "We only have one problem." And I said, "What's that?" She said, "On Halloween, we have to buy hundreds of pounds of candy." So many children come to our home for candy. And but they considered it humorous. My sister-in-law, who lived her whole life in Murray, one time took us outside of her home and pointed to the whole row of new homes off in the distance on a ridge that was a new Mormon polygamous ward. And everyone knows this. I mean, what bountiful Salt Lake, Murray. We have relatives who know exact which houses the polygamists live in, and they seem to be just like normal people except for their religion. In other words, it is not a closed society. Their children go to public schools. They have a decent education. They're not brainwashed from childhood that everyone outside of their community is evil.
Well, let me answer your question. In a lot of different Jewish and Christian groups, there are denominations or movements within those groups that decide that they want to be apart from the Gentile world. And this goes back to the Old Testament, where you leave the ungodly, leave Babylon, build Zion. And so, for example, within Judaism, you have the Hasidic Jews that live apart and separate, not only from the Gentile world, but also from other Jews. The Amish, somebody mentioned earlier that the Amish are open. Actually, you could drive through an Amish community, but the Amish do not socialize generally with non-Amish.
Yes.
They keep to themselves. And you're shunned from the community if you're caught, kind of violating that tenet.
Yes.
Well, within Mormonism, it's kind of the same thing. There are groups within Mormonism that do not interpret literally the command to separate yourself from the Gentiles. They interpret it spiritually of saying, in my own heart, I will be a righteous person here within the middle, of Babylon, basically. And then there are other groups that take a more literal, interpretation of that command to separate yourselves. And they want to do so physically, not only to keep away, from Gentile influences, but also to build up internally within themselves their own subculture, their own way of doing things, without kind of having it in your face that someone else is doing it differently. So it's just a different interpretation of how to build Zion and how to separate yourselves from Babylon.
Okay, I have just two small questions on what you said. One is that it seems to me those who separate themselves completely are more interested in maintaining their own power and control over human beings and human minds and human spirits. I don't know why it is that the law will prosecute people who are polygamists in a big group like that, and no one even talks about the ones that are out in our neighborhoods all over Utah, or maybe every state, for as far as I know. I have no idea why the law prosecutes some and not others, and why it is that the groups that separate themselves maintain such complete control with locks and keys on to keep everyone out.
Ben, do you want Ben or you?
Well,
you
go ahead. Yeah.
And then you want to comment after that?
Yeah. I just wanted to address that briefly as a parent. And I think that sometimes we can look at a religious community like the Amish or the FLDS and say that it's because of religious control that they're exercising these values upon their children and they're keeping their entire community closed off. I will stand here as a parent right now and tell you today, if I had a compound to go to that I could lock down and grow my own food and keep my children in there, I would. And why? Because of the world that we live in today. And perhaps that, I'm not saying that that's the reason that they do it, but I am saying that there are a lot of people in the modern world today, attachment parenting people in particular, who reject this model of public education, of the institutionalization and the public brainwashing of our children, the corporate media and the logo control. And they don't want their children growing up in that. They don't want their children knowing the McDonald arches before they can speak. My children have no reference for the fast food except maybe one. And I keep that as close as possible. But anyways, I just think that in the communities such as Amish and FLDS, it might not be always a religious control. Like the picture showed, they make their own homemade toys. It might be, hey, this is Babylon, whatever you call it in your tradition. The culture we have now is, and I refer to it as Babylon just because that's a good word to use. I don't want my children exposed to it. They're brainwashed in it. I keep my children as separate from it as possible. And that's another reason that they may be doing this as well. So I think that we need to kind of keep that in our awareness.
Brainwashing was good.
I want to keep us moving so we can get all the questions. Go ahead.
To answer your question about the law and why not every polygamist is prosecuted is basically, you know, you do have a religious freedom argument that is still kind of out there and looming. And what we've seen in prosecutions in Utah and Arizona, at least where bigamy is used, it appears that bigamy is used as an enhancement when you have a case of an underage marriage. You have a child abuse allegation, and then you throw in bigamy as an enhancement because it's a second-degree felony. So, you know, in another way, what that also avoids is a fast track to the U.S. Supreme Court, where you would have that religious freedom argument. In all of the appeals that have taken place, at least on convictions where you have bigamy, that was the person was convicted of bigamy, in each case, you know, there have been appeals recently, the Holm decision, and recently Kelly Fisher, as of yesterday in Arizona, the argument was on a religious freedom ground, but the courts came back and said, yeah, but the case was, in the instant case, it is an underage person who was the bride in this case, and that's why the courts have upheld that it's not protected by religious freedom. If you have a case, though, and there have been civil lawsuits that have been filed but haven't really gone anywhere, but if you have consenting adults participating in bigamy, the prevailing theory, at least among a lot of legal analysts and people involved in these cases, is that's pretty much fast-tracked to the U.S. Supreme Court to consider polygamy and maybe overturn the Reynolds decision.
But also, Tom Green was the test case for the big. I mean, it was bigamy.
But it was rape of a child.
Yeah.
But bigamy was thrown in.
Bigamy was thrown in as an enhancement.
Yeah.
So same in the Holm case.
Right. They will not even address the bigamy question if there's a minor involved. All the courts have come back that way.
Okay. Next question.
I just have a question. I mean, I love the fact you point out there's this tension. It seems absolutely accurate, but how do we get around, if we can try to craft a model solution or go back in time and say what should the authorities have done to both address the child abuse potential, the either actual or potential problems, but not get into these structural, systematic removals, what sort of suggestions would you make or ideas going forward?
And I'll be happy to turn that over, but I see Nadine waiting in line, and I think she'd give an excellent answer to that question. Do you want to take a crack at that, Nadine, answering his question?
I'm sorry, but I was
Oh, okay, sorry. Okay, well, would someone on the panel like to address John or Ben?
I don't really, you know, take a position, as you stated your question, on it one way or the other, because one of my jobs, I think, is just to observe what's happening and accurately report on what's happening. And so I'm critical towards both sides of it to a certain extent. I think, though, that one of the key principles needs to be is that you don't treat someone either better or worse because of their religious beliefs. And I think one of the primary problems in Texas was, and I know some of the people personally that were involved in this, I looked them in the face, I sat down with them, I talked with them, is that they were operating largely out of a Southern Baptist, conservative Protestant standpoint, and that colored all of their decisions. It really did. And so for someone to say this wasn't about, you know, religion, this was all about religion. At the end of the day, you know, the evidence that's been produced so far has been that we have a few teenage girls out of hundreds of families that engaged in consensual relations, possibly, and not even all of them. Okay. And that's what we have. And if this had happened in any other community, the police wouldn't even be talking about it. For example, in the Chronicle, which is my paper in Houston, it's a large paper, they had a report at the same time this was going on where they said a girl in foster care, 17 years old, under state custody, was forcibly raped while she was in foster care. And she was told by the authorities that they did not have the resources to investigate this claim. And her lawyer, who's mouthing off to the Chronicle, is basically saying, I don't understand this. You've got hundreds and hundreds of people working this situation in El Dorado, and this girl was raped. She's in state custody. You're responsible for her, and you're basically just closing out the case and moving on. And so, you know, from my perspective, all I heard when I was in San Angelo on multiple occasions and was talking with multiple people was this was all about religion. And so I think the way forward is for, you know, the state to simply back off and to say, listen, how would we treat specific allegations? We have an allegation of a 16-year-old girl being intimate with, you know, a 38-year-old man, let's say. Okay, well, how do we normally deal with this in Texas and treat it the same way?
Also, I would just add, you know, that tension between individual freedom and individual abuse is an important tension. Also, cultural sensitivity versus human rights abuses. There was a central problem in there, and how do you prove that there's an abusive system that is putting children in immediate danger who have not been abused yet? There was a concern that there was a systemic mechanism of abuse in place that was putting the children in immediate danger. And one suggestion, and actually this came from Nadine, I'm probably stealing your question, was that they could have maybe tried to remove the teen girls and just the teen girls, because they would be the ones, based on the evidence, the ones who are in most immediate danger.
Pursuant to Texas law, if you take them all.
Let me just add one thing, actually.
And then I want to.
I referenced this in my talk. My personal feeling on how do you approach any of the polygamous communities is to build a bridge of communication, open the dialogue first and foremost. I think that some of the things that we're doing in Utah, while may not be perfect, but is a coordinated effort with Arizona and probably will expand to a multi-state effort, is in fact to get those resources available to polygamous people, and part of that is through opening the doors and building the trust. That didn't happen in Texas, so the raid happened and it's spilt milk at this point, and I don't know that we can't really roll it back and say maybe we could change that, you know.
Good point. Okay, next question.
Ayla touched on this, but I hope my question won't require just a repeat. You can go a little bit beyond this, but one of the things we were talking about with Terry and some other people last night was the issue of education and the fact that that within this particular group, the educational system was not, they were not just being, quote, homeschooled, but they were also being schooled in a particular way that wasn't mainstream. And so the educational system was questionable. And so I'm wondering if any of you, Anna, Terry, anybody else, can speak to this, the extent to which you think the issue of education was also something, is also that something drives persecution of polygamous groups, and that tension between the right to parent and teach at home or in a sequestered environment, And with that tension between this Protestant drive for public education, which we all know is a Protestant ethic. Mm-hmm. So if y'all could speak.
Good question. We only have 2 minutes left, so John, do you want to answer that? And then Nadine, yeah, I would like to take Nadine's question.
I'll just quickly answer your question about education.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Non-fundamentalist Mormon, their children are schooled public, private, and homeschool. Our average, not including FALDS, is 90% high school graduates. In the state of Utah, it's 85% to 90%. So we really, in the fundamentalist Mormon community, have a higher rate of high school graduates than in the state of Utah generally.
Thanks. Does that answer? Okay. John, did you want to add something?
Just a very quick comment. I'm not sure that education in itself led to it, but I think that when these type of events have happened throughout history, what you always find out is it's much easier to demonize people that you don't know and that you don't socialize with. And going back to the other question of that there are some groups of people that like to isolate themselves so they can live their religion in purity, and then there are others that try to be pure in their hearts and stay in mainstream. One of the practical, and I don't take a side of which, an opinion on which side of that is right, but one of the practical issues of if you do segregate yourselves, you are allowing other people to more easily define you. And you are allowing them also that if you choose not to respond to false allegations, if you turn the other cheek entirely and so forth, it allows this vacuum of misinformation to occur. And so from that aspect, if I were going to give advice to the FLDS, it's like, I understand and I respect where you're coming from and your desire to segregate yourselves, but I would very seriously not look at just public spokespeople, but I would look very seriously at, are there ways that we can interact in the community in such a way to ensure that these vacuums do not occur again, because that's the best way to ever prevent something like this happening again, in my opinion.
Okay, Nadine, your question.
Just first of all, I know that they said that in Texas, if there's abuse, you take all the children. But in fact, one of the justices on the appellate court wrote a dissenting and concurring opinion in which that justice said that they would have ruled that it was that the state made their case in taking the teenage girls, but not as to the rest of the children. So I believe that was an option for CPS. Also, I've worked in child protective services system in California, and I have no problem at all saying that I'm appalled by what the state of Texas did, and I don't think it ever would have happened in any jurisdiction where I practice to remove all the children under those circumstances. I won't belabor the point since it's on account of time, but I do want to just make one other statement. As someone who lives near polygamists, I think people should be aware that while they do live in an insular community, it's not like they're locked up in that community. I can't go to the store without seeing polygamists. They drive cars. They have cell phones. I occasionally talk to them in the store. They don't run and hide from me. And the men do their businesses, many construction businesses, completely out, and most of their work is done for Gentiles. So while it is a closed society in one sense, it's not like the people never interact with the outside world.
Very good point.
Thank you, good point. Marion? Is that Marion? No. No.
Okay. I was teaching at Jordan High School when Warren Jeffs, and I taught him in English, and also his sister, Alice. Warren was very close, cold type of personality. Alice was just open and free and really fun. But it was the year after that because they were not allowed to shower together, because they did not want to shower together, that they took them out of the public schools and started their own schools. If there's time, I do have a question. The records that have been taken from the church and so on, I'm wondering if there is any kind of there are any charges that are going to be made regarding financial misuse of money and within the FLDS community.
We'll let Ben answer that, and then we will dismiss.
Well, in answer to the records, a lot of this remains under investigation, and so despite my best efforts, there's a lot that's not being said. There's a number of different cases going forward, though, dealing with financial records. I don't know how many of you have followed the United Effort Plan Trust, which was the real estate holdings arm of the FLDS Church, and in 2005, a number of people went to the courts and basically alleged that Warren Jeffs and other FLDS leadership had mismanaged it, and the state courts took control of it. A judge is in charge of it, and she's appointed a special fiduciary who has attorneys, and they've been trying to reform it pursuant to court-ordered reforms. In terms of recovering assets, though, that belong to the UEP, at least the claim is that they're trying to recover assets, what they're doing is they're going to a number of states, issuing subpoenas, following evidence that kind of seems to dovetail the criminal investigation in a lot of ways. So that's also being pursued. It's also led to more documents being made public in court, at least, as to what's going on. The bottom line is they are pursuing assets, at least civilly, the UEP is, and the special fiduciary to satisfy a judgment that he also obtained for mismanaging the trust. And then there are also now, though, the FLDS, some members who are involved in the UEP are now suing, or at least challenging, petroleum evictions in court. And so now, where before you had default judgments and things like that, at least the pledge has been that they will be fighting it. In terms of financial crimes, the U.S. Attorney for Utah has said that he has tried to look into that. Utah's Attorney General has said that he's had an organized crime investigation ongoing. It's just a matter of what evidence they can get their hands on, and at this point, it appears that that's all still locked up, maybe in Texas.
Thank you. Well, we are 5 minutes over. I want to thank our panelists. Aren't they great? Let's give them a hand. We thank you all for staying to the bitter end. Mm-hmm.